Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast. This is Joy Mason-Intriago, Managing Director of the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. We are the only professional association that combines all aspects of data and cyber governance for the governance, risk, and compliance professional. You can find us online at adcg.org. It gives us great pleasure to host this event led by two outstanding moderators, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. Jerry is a founder of Buckley LLP, a national financial services law firm based in Washington, D.C. Prior to entering private practice, he served as minority staff director of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Jody is CEO of Global Cyber Risk LLC and chairs the American Bar Association's Privacy and Computer Crime Committee. We have some really great guests lined up today and in the future, so please be sure to rate us and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
Hello, this is Jerry Buckley, and I am here with my co-host, Jody Westby. Our guest today is Jamie Danker, who is Vice President of Privacy at Easy Dynamics Corporation, where she leads the privacy practice delivering privacy risk management, privacy engineering, and privacy program management for the firm's clients. Jamie's earlier career was in government, where she held several privacy positions at the Department of Homeland Security, including what is now known as the Cyber and Infrastructure Agency. She and her team implemented the Privacy Compliance Review Framework at DHS. In her earlier career, she worked on privacy issues at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. And in prior conversations, she and I talked, and we both had a lot of interaction with GAO, which is really a fantastic organization. Jamie, you have had a ringside seat for the last couple of decades watching the evolution of privacy and data security policy. And you have been at the center of decision-making related to the federal government's use of data. Let's start out by asking how things have changed since you first started following privacy issues early in your career. How have expectations evolved? And since you had a chance to observe privacy law implementation both inside government and outside, we would be interested in your observations that you might have comparing the way data is protected in the federal government and in the private sector.
All right. Well, thanks for inviting me to this podcast. Looking forward to this discussion. I guess getting to your first question made me kind of go back and reflect on many of the GAO reports that I worked on. I mean, my first job, I had 15 years in the Federal Civil Service, 6.5 years at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. I'd actually been an intern when it was called the General Accounting Office. And I think one of the actually reports I worked on was looking at website privacy practices. So that would have been back in 2000. And then when I officially joined GAO in the civil service, it was in 2001 and kind of had exposure to what were called the e-government initiatives. So that was post-e-government act. And then kind of when I really saw both information security and privacy was working on a report on the implementation status of the e-government act of 2002. So that, it had obviously FISMA in it, but had lots of different provisions on electronic government initiatives. So I think one of my first more like leadership roles at GAO was, the analyst in charge role where you're kind of designing the whole engagement. And that involves kind of really deconstructing criteria, which would have been the e-government act in that case, and then kind of going out to interview the agencies to see their progress on things. So, it was a very broad-based brush review, but one of the provisions was Section 208 of the e-government act, and that required agencies to conduct privacy impact assessments. So it was sort of very early, and I was looking back through the GAO reports, and it was December 2004 when we had issued that report. Just giving that broad-based review. So it was not real in-depth on how agencies were doing PIAs, but that was sort of the more forward-leaning privacy practice back, I guess, in 2004, only a couple years after the e-government act had passed. And, you know, the Privacy Act, of course, the Privacy Act of 1974 still remains largely unchanged, but you already had privacy law there. It just was in applied to systems of records. So you could see that there was a level of protection under this one construct under the Privacy Act, and then the E-Government Act added, I think, just another level of transparency. Whereas, you know, Privacy Act, you have procedures that do promote transparency, but, you know, kind of, I feel like they promote transparency for the informed public or, you know, privacy or compliance professionals who know how to look in the Federal Register. So, I mean, I would say one observation is, I think, how have things changed? I think, you know, the constructs for, you know, privacy have changed a little bit, somewhat evolved. But they still may not be comprehensive enough. So I think there are more transparency mechanisms in the federal government than perhaps in other areas. But and then expectations of course, you know, I guess in the two decades I've seen things, I guess in the commercial sector, I'd say expectations of privacy have changed, but it really depends on who you talk to. Because I think privacy is a really personal thing. You know, I have a almost 10-year-old, and I think her expectations of privacy are far different than what I would expect.
Is that less or more expectation of privacy on the part of your 10-year-old?
I think she just doesn't understand. I think she just doesn't understand the consequences, and I think that's kind of the state of things today. Is that I think we're just a much more open society. People are sort of oversharing in many cases. Which may not be a problem, but I think it becomes a problem when it has adverse impacts on individuals. And I think the ability for people to really comprehend how their data is used is very difficult. So, and thinking about my 10-year-old too, like, you know, there are things I know I've tried to do, her Girl Scout troop. I mean, thinking of things that have changed in two decades, I think I did brownies growing up. They never had a cybersecurity badge, but the Girl Scouts have a cybersecurity badge. And guess who got to teach the troop? Cybersecurity. And yeah, so that was actually a lot of fun. And then, you know, talking to the girls about, you know, how to stay safe online and what to share and not to share, and basically don't share your personally identifiable information online. And it's very funny, you know, my daughter loves Roblox, but she knows she can't connect with people she doesn't know. So when she's connecting, you know, she'll go on Roblox and be online with her friend, and then she'll go on like Google Hangouts and they'll have audio while they're playing the game, and they're talking about, oh, somebody wants to be friends with them. And I hear my daughter saying, oh, no, we learned in the cybersecurity course that we're not supposed to, you know, connect with people we don't know. So, you know, some of it does resonate. I think kids can start to understand that a little bit more.
Jamie, tell me, how is it teaching Girl Scouts about cookies?
Oh, gosh. Sorry. That they're tracked and monitored everywhere they go? Now,
well, it depends on whether it's s'mores or it's the mint cookies. It depends what kind. Sorry.
So I would say they
just a little levity.
A little levity, yeah. The love the privacy and the cookie jokes. But you just reminded me that like we signed up to sell 125 boxes, so we need to get on that pretty soon. But the topic of cookies, I think that'll have to be like, you know, cybersecurity level 5 for the girls, and about their digital cookie crumbs that they leave all over the place when they go online.
That is helpful. And I think it gives us a sense of the evolution and your view that privacy, I'm taking from what you say, is perhaps receives a little more respect and attention inside the federal government, putting aside intelligence agencies and so forth, than is always found in the private sector. Is that a fair takeaway from what you said?
I think that's a pretty fair takeaway, and I think there are good reasons for that. I mean, federal government obviously has like special powers, you know, that they can impact your rights, benefits, or privileges. So I think it makes sense that you have a set of protections, you know, that you'd be able to access your record, you'd be able to correct that record. You get to see an accounting of disclosures if you request it. So I think it makes a lot of sense. And then I of course, you know, I am not an attorney. I know that you are, you know, as you know, that we have a sectoral approach in the US. And so there are sectors where it could have an impact on an individual, like the financial sector. And so you have laws there too. So I wouldn't claim that the government necessarily does it better. I think there's some ways I think maybe they do it a little better, or they have more rules and structure around it. And, mm-hmm. and with that, I think like privacy compliance, you know, with the Privacy Act and eGov Act, you know, there are rules around when you collect information in such a way and it can impact an individual's rights, benefit, or certain privileges. And then, you know, the requirement to have to do impact assessments too. So I think those are, it's a little bit different than I think what you see in the private sector. But that said, I still think that the privacy principles that still underlie both government and commercial use, you know, things like transparency and individual participation, data quality, you know, the principles everybody knows and loves.
Well, you know, our mutual friend, Carlos Solari, who chairs the ABC Board of Advisors, has suggested that the title of this podcast be The End of PII, because the concept of personally identifiable information seems to have been overtaken by developments in artificial intelligence that allow predictions of individual behavior and life outcomes to be developed without regard to whether the data is supplied by an individual. The consequences for the legal and regulatory regime governing data use are significant. Increasingly, the consent process is perceived as ineffective in giving individuals control over their digital persona. Based on your experience in government and now in the private sector, where do you see the regulatory policy leading with respect to data protection?
So I can completely see why Carlos would say, you know, a good title for this would be The End of PII, because I think one observation I've had, you know, if I look at the beginning of my career, I would say that as technology evolves, the constructs that we have in law seem to be a little bit outdated. Now they can kind of adapt through policies so you can interpret it. But if you think about the Privacy Act of 1974 and the System of Records Notice construct, that was developed when you would pull out a file cabinet to pull out Jerry Buckley's case file because it was retrieved out of a file cabinet. And that obviously isn't the modern way in which we're retrieving data. It's automated. I mean, that said, I still think, you know, the Privacy Act still works quite well. But I mean, even thinking back to, I was looking back at some of the old GAO reports I worked on. It was back in 2008. It was a report entitled Alternatives Exist for Enhancing Protection of PII. So PII was in the title. And one of the engagement objectives was to assess, you know, the adequacy of existing privacy laws, and especially looking at the Privacy Act of 1974 and trying to identify some alternatives for Congress to consider amendments to the Privacy Act. And at that time, one of the findings was, you know, trying to apply privacy protections consistently to all federal collections of personal information, because the Privacy Act had a specific definition of, you know, where its protections applied. So there was a consideration to revise that definition to cover all PII. And now I look back at that and, you know, it seemed very novel at the time to make that recommendation, but even to say, you know, to cover all PII may not even do it justice, because like you said, as technology evolves, you may have information that is, you know, looking on its face is not identifiable, but it may have an impact on individuals. So I don't think the construct of PII is going away, but I think you're going to see broader interpretations of it. If you look at the Office of Management and Budget definition of PII, which is already reflected in policy, it's pretty broad. I mean, it's linked or linkable, and also acknowledges the fact that as context changes, you might have privacy risk. So where's the regulatory policy going? I don't have a crystal ball. I don't think that the PII definition will go away, because I do think people need something to kind of hold on to so they know, you know, where to attach protections. But I do think you're going to see potentially like maybe requirements for conducting risk assessments. So, you know, maybe you have a set of data that on its own doesn't seem identifiable, but that through artificial intelligence would result in some sort of impact. You know, so perhaps there could be requirements for risk assessment that would make you look at impacts of data processing more broadly. And that kind of leads to how the NIST privacy framework deals with, you know, you won't see, and I know this kind of will get to your next question, you don't see personally identifiable information in the NIST privacy framework. It's data and data processing. And I think that was very intentional. One, you know, if an organization has a specific definition, they can always fit that into data. But as technology evolves, the data definition is broad enough that you can use that.
Hey, Jamie, let me jump in here. This is Jody. And thank you again for being with us today. So, you know, the topic of these podcasts is examining what whether national privacy legislation is possible and what are the main issues surrounding that whole discussion. However, we do have a federal privacy law that applies to the U.S. government, the Privacy Act of 1974. So where the private sector does not have a federal law, the government does. And the PII definition for what the government protects is different than some of the laws necessarily. It's not exactly the same on the private sector side. Do you see do you hear talk about if we have a federal privacy law that would usurp or preempt the Federal Privacy Act of 1974 and that the government might have a broader responsibility for privacy than it does now if we had a federal privacy law that applied to both public and private sector?
Gosh, I'd never thought of that question before. I actually don't see a federal privacy law touching how federal government addresses records, again, because I just think it's just fundamentally different, the government's powers over individuals versus commercial entities. I mean, it's definitely something interesting to explore. But, you know, the way the Privacy Act of 1974 is structured, I think already offers, sure, there could be improvements, but you already have aspects of, you know, the fair information practice principles addressed in the Privacy Act from, you know, transparency, you know, requiring agencies to go through kind of administrative processes to collect the information in the first place, provide notice, allow people to access their records. And this, those are especially important in cases where you're making a decision about an individual. So I think the Privacy Act does actually a pretty good job of that. You know, do all individuals understand how the government's using their data? I would say probably not, but I don't think it's necessarily any better in the private sector. I think what a lot of people don't know about, and maybe this is because I spent so long at Department of Homeland Security in their privacy office, you know, there was a lot of effort there put into baking privacy into the earliest stages. And yes, you have to do certain things because, you know, the Privacy Act requires you to publish something in the Federal Register, but citizens probably don't go to that.
No.
So you have impact assessments. There is a plethora of information on many agency websites that you can learn about what the government is doing with data. And sometimes it's not always impact assessment.
Well, it does have a private right of action that it allows you to sue if you have your protections under the Privacy Act violated. So it does have that, which is interesting to think about how the private sector is resisting that. But, you know, we will have to keep our eyes on that because, as you were saying before, the definition of PII is expanding now to include digital identifiers and cookies and lots of other things that we didn't think is PII before. So the strict term of PII is, as you said, it's really broadening. But the federal law doesn't include some of the data subject rights that we're starting to see in state laws and certainly in the GDPR. So in that sense, I could see.
So what kind of rights do you think that the GDPR has that like the Privacy Act doesn't, for example?
The right to have your data corrected.
So that does exist. Under the Privacy Act of 1974, you have the right to request your record and request amendment. Now, it doesn't always apply if it's like a law enforcement record, for example. Agencies can file exemptions from disclosure. But currently, the Privacy Act does, they've had, you know, that's been in the Privacy Act, I think, since it was passed into law. You can access, you can correct, you can request amendment. Agencies have policies and procedures. Sometimes they're through their Freedom of Information Act processes. But, you know, sometimes you can't have it corrected because if it's, you know, sometimes an agency, and you have to have a certain type of record to get an exemption.
Yeah.
From the amendment.
Is deletion in there?
No, and that I think actually, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that deletion is not always a right because of the Federal Records Act. Right. So again, like you're talking about your, like, let's say somebody is filing for citizenship, you know, they're a legal permanent resident, their records for that naturalization file are going to be covered under the Privacy Act.
Yeah.
And so they don't have the right to just like delete their record. The Citizenship and Immigration Services has the need to maintain that record. So there's really no right to be forgotten like there is in GDPR for government records. And I don't know as much about GDPR as I do about the Privacy Act. But I'd wonder, you know, how does GDPR, I don't know that GDPR addresses government.
Well, you know, all private sector companies have the same problem in that they there are many state laws have requirements for retention. Public sector companies have retention requirements. And so they may bump up against someone saying, I want you to delete my data. They may say, well, we can't because we have a legal right that we have to keep it for an amount of time. But, you know, listening to you and having this little discussion that we sort of developed impromptu here makes me wonder if when people start getting really serious about having a federal privacy law, if they don't pick up this Privacy Act of 1974 and say, let's just amend this and extend it to the private sector. It's a place to start.
Yeah.
Interesting thought.
That is an interesting thought. Yeah. Again, like I said, I never really thought, I've often had thoughts that like, I feel like there's not awareness of the privacy protections that are in place for government records or like the, even the privacy infrastructure. Like Jody, you mentioned you supported the Science and Technology Directorate, and I'm sure you're aware of like all the privacy processes that were in place. I don't think, you know, the general public really understands that, you know, there are civil servants, even political appointees that are, you know, helping to ensure, you know, not only the security of information, but, you know, the privacy of information as well, which extends beyond just confidentiality concerns.
Well, so. I'll tell you where I don't think the public has any concept of what the government does is with privacy impact assessments.
Yeah.
I don't think the public's aware of the degree that the government goes to conduct privacy impact assessments with respect to the data that it's going to be holding and processing. And it's, you know, I did several of those when I was working with DHS, and they're comprehensive. They really raise all the right questions. There's, you know, templates for them. And I don't think the private sector, you know, very few of my private sector clients have ever done a privacy impact assessment unless they felt they had to for GDPR or some other compliance requirement. And so, you know, the California Privacy Rights Act, if it comes into force before some federal legislation may preempt it, it requires privacy impact assessments. Mm-hmm. But this really hasn't been widely adopted in the private sector. Do you think that the government could play a bigger role in helping the private sector understand the value of PIAs? I mean, they certainly support the risk-based approach that, you know, underlies NIST and it underlies ISO. And I mean, you've had a lot of experience with the government PIAs. Can you tell us a bit about them and how you think they might support a private sector role?
Sure. And I'll even take it a step further and say that, you know, PIAs, if they're treated just as a compliance exercise, they're just that. They're just a compliance document. But I think if you instill privacy risk assessment practices within your PIA process, you're pretty golden. I've seen, and I'll try to give an example of that. I don't think every federal agency does a great job at it. And, you know, my experience was at DHS. And so I think they take them very seriously. There's a reason for that, you know, and when the department was established, they were the first statutorily required privacy office. And so with that, I think with that recognition, they built a strong office, and that office really matured. And you saw the privacy infrastructure not being just at a department level, but it kind of it goes all the way down to each of the components, including, you know, citizenship and immigration services and TSA, and you know all the components. But
clarify for our audience that the 22 government agencies that were folded together to create DHS are now called 13 components. So that's what we're talking about here is components.
Yes. So there are 13 components, you know, lots of there and you know, Homeland Security has a lot of different interesting privacy issues because especially with privacy, if you collect information for one purpose, you got to make sure if you share it, it's compatible with the purpose that it was collected. And so you've got a mishmash of agencies, some are benefits administration, you know, disaster assistance, and then you've got the Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency. So, it, you know, just because it's Homeland Security doesn't mean they get to use it for all those different purposes.
Let me go back. You said privacy impact assessments. I was asking if the government could help lead the private sector into
it.
And then you said also privacy risk assessments. Mm-hmm. Are you saying these are two separate processes? And if so, can you define them?
I think they can be part of a privacy impact assessment process. I think just my experience in government is that not all agencies take the impact assessment process very seriously, and there could be reasons for that. It could be resourcing issues. For privacy risk assessment, I think it's a sub-process of risk assessment. It could be part of an impact assessment. Like, I think DHS has a very robust privacy impact assessment process. And so there are elements of doing the risk assessment there. But if you're just an agency and you're just filling out a template, I think what I'm really talking about for a privacy risk assessment is, you know, I look to NIST 8062, the Introduction to Privacy Engineering in Federal Information Systems. And there's a really cool tool there that I've started using with my clients called the Privacy Risk Assessment Methodology. And it does have a lot of similarities to doing a privacy threshold analysis. The first worksheet is, you know, called Frame Organizational Governance. But then the second worksheet, you know, working with a client right now, you know, it really helps you dig down deep into what are the data actions, what are the data elements, and then even drawing a data map that shows you the data flows, and it really can kind of help you identify where risks might occur.
Is that for the NIST privacy framework?
So I think the NIST privacy framework is really built on the foundation of privacy risk assessment and some of those foundational concepts that were introduced in 8062, including this privacy risk assessment methodology. So if you look at the NIST privacy framework in the identify and govern categories, I believe it's an identify, but I might be wrong, it might be govern. But risk assessment is a foundational item to do when you're looking at the NIST privacy framework. And you know, just because you're saying you're applying a framework doesn't mean anything until you like apply the rigor that goes underneath it. So like if risk assessment is important to you, then you know, you would apply a methodology to conduct that risk assessment, and you can go to NIST privacy risk assessment methodology to conduct that risk assessment. So there's one tool out there that's available to the public to use that really lets you visualize the flow of data if you're working on a system. You know, in one instance, I've been working with a federal client where I work with our engineers, and they took architecture diagrams for the system for building a privacy preserving attribute validation service. And so we wanted to visualize the data flows. And so I worked with them to, instead of just doing this, you know, straight up architecture diagrams, we layered a data map over the architecture diagrams, and it allowed us to ask questions like if we were going to use a third party vendor to send attributes. It allowed us to say, oh, let's ask the question, you know, how long do you retain the data for? Or allowed us to dictate a requirement to the third party. After 7 days, we want you to drop this data on the floor. So I think that's the kind of rigor that really feeds into a good impact assessment process. People use PIAs and the term differently. At DHS, I think it can be a process, which is, you know, the process of working with the system owners from the very early stages to gather the data, ask the questions that are kind of based on fair information practice principles. And then the document is what is the transparency document that's sort of, it's almost like the report after you've gone through the impact assessment process. But a really good impact assessment process, you've actually influenced the system design.
Yeah. I want to clarify for our audience that what we're discussing here is document NIST IR 8062. Which is an introduction to privacy engineering and risk management in federal systems. So it's NISTIR 8062.
That's right.
Yeah. And one last really quick question. I have to give this back to Jerry. But you basically, I think if I heard you right, say that all the departments in the federal agency do impact assessments the way they want to. They don't all necessarily use the same template. Is that right?
Correct. You know, all agencies have to follow OMB's Office of Management and Budget Foundational Policy, A130. There is still existing guidance on impact assessments. I think it's M0322. But it gives agencies the flexibility on kind of the format, and they have to address the key elements of OMB requirements, but every agency does it a little bit differently.
I think DHS does it best.
I mean, I guess I'm biased. I haven't been at other agencies. I would also argue that DHS has the most resource privacy function of most federal agencies. So
it does strike me, by the way, if you cast your mind back to your days at GAO, it does make it hard to audit if each agency has its own impact procedures. Do you think there would be any benefit in uniformity?
So I actually don't see difficulty there. I mean, thinking back to my GAO career, actually, one of my first forays into privacy was, you know, I think, I can't remember which committee it was, we looked at how was the Homeland Security Privacy Office meeting its mandate. So, you know, I think I audited them before I actually joined them. But from an audit perspective, you would look at the criteria would be like, what's the law say you're supposed to do? What does the OMB guidance say you're supposed to do? And what does agency policy and guidance say? And you would evaluate their process based on those, you know, the criteria. Would it make it easier? Potentially, but I think every agency maybe has a different risk tolerance or different set of concerns. Like Homeland Security, I think like Jody and I were saying, you know, they have 13 components, varying missions. So they may have heightened privacy risks or sensitivities versus like a very small micro agency. So I don't think there's always a one size fits all, but Terry, you do raise sort of an interesting point that I hear, especially like having worked on NIST documents, is that sometimes when things are in a NIST document, then there's the fear that you get an auditor that doesn't really understand privacy and, you know, they're going to get dinged for something that like they really, you know, they really shouldn't be getting dinged for. But that kind of leads to sort of another tangent too on, you know, the need for a robust privacy workforce. And I think that's true in the federal government. It's true in the private sector. It's a very hot topic, but there's not a huge recruiting pool. NIST actually had a workshop on this over the summer.
That's something that ADCG is going to be trying to do something about, and Jody as well, in trying to provide more training and more education to people so that we can expand that workforce and provide more opportunity for the individuals who want to be a part of it. It certainly is a need in our society. You know, our time is limited, and in fact, But just one last question, which is kind of an open-ended one. You know, as Jody referenced, what we're focused on in generally in this podcast series is whether, when, and how national privacy legislation might emerge. We welcome your thoughts based on your experience and what the key elements of a national privacy law would be if you could write it yourself.
Yeah, I think I have a wish list that still aligns with, you know, fair information practice principles. I think it's important to have transparency mechanisms. You know, they say sunshine is the greatest disinfectant. I'd heard that the California law was really intended to be sort of a Freedom of Information Act for consumers. And I think there's a lot of value there. I think attributes about having meaningful control, not just, you know, the ability to request your record, but like, you know, the ability to actually have meaningful control over your data. I know that's easier said than done, but you're asking for my wish list. I would also personally like to see privacy risk assessment, like a risk-based approach, but also encouragement of privacy risk assessment practices, which, you know, I think the NIST privacy framework encourages. And I think that goes both ways. So like, we don't want to spend a lot of time worrying about data that doesn't raise a whole lot of risk to individuals or organizations, but we do want to spend a lot of time on, you know, highly sensitive systems. And I think also, I don't know how this gets wrapped up into a law too, but you got to see organizations contributing resources or, you know, having an accountable official for privacy. And I guess if I look at DHS, I think part of the reason you have a more robust privacy program there is because it was put in statute that they've dedicated some resources to it. And I think you get bang for your buck there. But if organizations just designate an accountable official and they don't put resources toward it, then it just seems to me like it's a figurehead. Those are
important observations. And I hope we'll be able to, in the audience that we have, we'll have some who are going to be engaged in trying to shape the way privacy legislation might emerge. And those are all good suggestions. So thank you. Jamie, any last observations on where you see privacy moving?
This has been a fascinating discussion. I mean, it's led into a space that I don't think we anticipated and we got into it. But in looking at the federal privacy law, the requirements for privacy impact assessments, varying templates, but with OMB guidance, and then this NIST guidance on the 8062 document for privacy risk management we were talking about, all of that is actually a very good body of work to look at when we're talking about a federal privacy law. And what we tend to do here is say, well, if it's a federal law, how much is it going to look like all the state laws? And then it could preempt the state laws, we'd have a federal law. But then when the rubber comes to the road, I find that increasingly we have to look across the pond and say, well, it's a federal privacy law. What do we need to do that the EU is doing so we're more harmonized globally? And so it may be, and the EU does have privacy impact assessments as a requirement. Mm-hmm. They do have a privacy impact template. And, you know, they have clear requirements. So it may be that when we come down to it, we're going to look more at the Privacy Act of 1974 and GDPR when we look at what could happen in the U.S. on federal.
And Jody, you just make me think of one other thing, because we were talking about the California law and we talked a little bit about the NIST privacy framework, and the NIST privacy framework is law agnostic. So I just wanted to point out that the NIST Privacy Framework website, they have a resource repository where, you know, members from the community can contribute mappings, crosswalks, et cetera. And, you know, they recently had a blog celebrating the first birthday of the Privacy Framework last week. And there are a lot of really cool resources available through the blog and the resource repository, including a crosswalk of the Privacy Framework to the California law. And I believe there's a contribution in there on GDPR as well. So you can take a look at that and kind of, you can kind of imagine how the NIST Privacy Framework could help you also help meet your privacy compliance obligations.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for joining us today and being with us. It's been a very interesting discussion and brought out a lot of good points we haven't discussed in previous episodes. And we thank you for giving us your time and your expertise. I think it's been very valuable.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. National Privacy Legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.